Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Jim, are you ready for Warren Zevon week?
Oh, yeah. I've got my notes ready. I've laid out my books. I've got my albums, CDs, and cassettes all lined up chronologically.
Wow. You're just an excitable Jim, aren't you?
All right, Patrick, so this is going to be an exciting week on the show because even though we're still not able to get together, we're still doing the social distancing thing, we have a special guest from his home in Washington, D.C. He's going to be on all week. We've had him on once before on a popular week of shows on hardcore. And this is not really hardcore, although it's hardcore, like lowercase h, I think. But in a different sort of way. But anyway, we'll get to that in a moment. The show you're listening to is Rockin' the Suburbs. We are in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., the two of us. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And this is Warren Zevon week, right?
Yes.
Yes. You should be more excited. I know you've been excited about this for quite a while.
I am.
So our friend Hunter Bennett, who's on. Hello, Hunter.
Yeah.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me back on.
Yep. Of course.
Of course, yes. He reached out and said he wanted to do Warren Zevon week after the hardcore week stuff. And we just kind of been waiting for the right time. And I don't know, if, you know, not that it matters that much or whatever, but I did notice that we're coming up on the anniversary of Warren Zevon's death, which plays into this story, I think, in some way, artistically and culturally. And so anyway, that's I'll look that up here, but it was that's coming up like next month, I want to say. So there you go.
Yeah,
that's all the peg
we need. September of '03. It was almost exactly a year after he was diagnosed.
September of 03. So not that we necessarily need a time peg, but it somehow made sense to me. So there you go. All right. So Hunter, again, welcome, and tell people a little bit about yourself and what you do and how you got interested in Warren Zevon.
Well, I as I think I told you guys last time I was on for Hardcore Week, I listened to pretty much nothing but hardcore from 1983 to 1991. And then, you know, I moved to Washington, D.C. and attended college because I liked the music, the hardcore of Washington, D.C. And I think predictably I failed out of college and then toured North America with a Washington, D.C. hardcore band that sort of collapsed spectacularly. And then so I found myself living back at my parents' house, delivering roses. I was a college flunk out. And then probably the greatest thing that ever happened to me in my life occurred in December of 1992. I woke up behind the wheel of an overturned car with no recollection of having gotten behind the wheel. Bob Seger's Night Moves was playing on the stereo. Thankfully, I did not injure myself or anybody else, but it sort of became apparent that I had a alcohol problem that I needed to deal with. So I went to rehab and sort of that triggered this really sort of exhilarating period of my life where I had to learn how to be sort of a functioning adult. And so I discovered a lot about myself, and I also discovered all this music that I had been steadfastly ignoring for the last, 9 or 10 years of my life. So, I started listening to everything. And then eventually, in about 1995, I found myself, I discovered Warren Zevon, who I was only sort of somewhat familiar with. And that kicked off, an obsession that probably was not as long as my hardcore obsession, but was every bit as intense. And so I have been waiting since 1995 for somebody to ask me to go deep cuts Warren Zevon. And you two are the people that have very nicely given me this opportunity. So I can't wait.
All right. Well, we're happy to do so. So, given your experiences, did Zevon's music and his, you know, life have a certain connection to you? I guess that does music mean more in some way, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, when you're 22 years old and you're sort of faced with like, and you're 22 years old and you obviously really enjoyed drinking a lot and devoted much of your life to it, it's pretty daunting to sort of have to think about facing the rest of your life without doing something that you like doing so much. And so I think I sort of sought out people that, you know, had substance abuse problems. And, you know, the first thing I did sort of as I was in rehab, I read a biography of Gram Parsons. And, you know, obviously that didn't turn out so well for him. But, you know, Warren Zevon was sort of one of the people that had been through it and come out the other side. So that was inspiring to me in a lot of ways. And he also just has sort of a gallows humor that you frequently find in people who, you know, are recovering alcoholics or drug addicts.
Yeah.
And I think that really appealed to me.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to do 5 days. Hunter has mapped this whole thing out. It's fantastic.
Yep.
It's, what is it? 20 some pages of notes that you put together. I think he's holding it up here for the camera.
Yeah. 26
pages of notes. I read through it all.
It's got some heft to it.
Yeah.
It's, you know,
it's a legal brief and I read through it all. And I just want to say in the email, when he sent the notes over, he said something to the effect of like, I kind of petered out at the end. Although, side note, I didn't notice that, but he said he kind of petered out at the end. I don't know how you guys do this every week, Patrick.
Yeah, well, I don't either.
Well, it assumes somehow that we prepare for the show, right?
Oh, well, yeah, yeah. Well, like Hunter said, I think there's a lot of personal living experience background material that's gone into some of our preparation too. And one thing, Hunter, I wanted to ask you about, as we dive into this, one thing people may not understand completely or may even grasp, because obviously it occurred before Warren Zevon really had become successful, you know, as a solo singer-songwriter, is this entire backstory that he had of his early career,
right,
where
right.
he was struggling to make it and touring with other bands and was in a duo. And I'd love to for you to kind of unpack some of that for our listeners.
So that's where the story's going to begin here.
Yeah.
This is great.
Yeah.
So, but real quickly, Patrick, I wanted to ask you before we do that, is there any sort of, you know, high level thoughts you want to give about Zevon and your fandom with Warren Zevon when you discovered him and what he means to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like many of the artists we've talked about on Rock in the Suburbs, I was lucky enough, you know, as I've repeated many times on this show, to be working in a record store with guys that were like 3 or 4 years older than me and sort of had gone through some period of discovery and separated the wheat from the chaff, you know, with a lot of artists. And it was just one of those things where one of the older guys at the record store I was working at, a chain record store in a mall in the suburbs of DC, said, "Well, you don't know Warren Zevon?" You know, like, he's one of the tentpoles, one of the pillars of stuff, in the same way I was pointed toward sort of Dylan records that weren't, you know, the famous Dylan records, and I was pointed toward Brian Eno and Warren Zevon actually in the same year. So I just was lucky enough to have somebody give me a recommendation to get Excitable Boy, and then, you know, I just read in the Rolling Stone Record Guide and other places, and we'll talk about this, I guess, right, Hunter?
Yeah.
He was critically adored, certainly, and but that didn't always translate to other things. So being a guy who followed the critics and wrote about music myself, he always seemed like somebody I should respect and treat his work, you know, with reverence.
And I think that was how I discovered him too. I think it was mostly from reading Rolling Stone and you know, because they would write about him because he was part of that, you know, that group. He hung around with a lot of and he worked with a lot of more successful artists, right? And he
totally.
Was sort of like, you know, and he just sort of fit in with the like Rolling Stone sort of crew of artists that they would write about. So and then I know I got Excitable Boy because I read, you know, it was one of the greatest albums. It was probably showed up on Rolling Stone lists of one of the great albums, you know, and so I got that when I was trying to really, you know, expand my horizons. And then the other one, other album that I got, which we'll get to later in the week, was Sentimental Hygiene because of the REM connection. And we'll talk about that later. But I kind of like, because of that reading and because of just, you know, like I said, the fact that I would sort of like read about or hear about Warren Zevon or talk about him with some of my, you know, music loving friends, I just kind of assumed that everybody knew him. And I was kind of surprised when I got out into the real world after college, you know, being in that like cocoon of college and college, you know, music and music nerds and everything. And then getting out in the real world and mentioning like, hey, Warren Zevon's playing something, that they'd be like, who?
Yeah.
Like he just was not very well known. And it's funny. And he even had a hit song, but we'll get into all of that. So,
And before we do, at the risk of making this episode 4 hours long, let me just say, I mean, one of the cool things about sort of the era in which the three of us grew up, and I suspect most of your listeners did as well, is like rock radio wasn't all the same. And so like rock radio, depending on regions, like my friend Seth from up the street grew up in Cleveland where the Michael Stanley Band were like the biggest thing in the world.
Yeah.
So, but you know, in Philly, we never heard them. But in Philly, for reasons that, you know, I found out later and that we'll talk about a little bit today, Warren Zevon was like big on local radio. They played him a lot and they had a live recording that they would play on WMMR. They would say from the WMM archives of Warren Zevon doing Werewolves of Bryn Mawr, because he was playing at the 23 East Cabaret on the main line, which is right near Bryn Mawr. And so, you know, he got played a lot. So that's how I knew the hits. And then, you know, as I said, in 1995, when I went deeper than the hits, I was just blown away.
Yeah. And I'll add just really quick. Plus, I never liked Zappa. So it was cool to have some Z records in your collection at the end that weren't Zappa.
There's one good Zappa record in my opinion anyway, and that's Cruising with Reuben and the Jets.
Oh yeah, the doo-wop record,
which is awesome.
It is good.
Okay, so let's dive into this document here. So, Hunter, kick us off. How does the Warren Zevon story begin?
Sure. So let's go back to Chicago in 1947, when Warren Zevon was born to a 40-something Jewish Ukrainian gangster father who went by Stumpy. I don't think that was his given name, but that's what everybody called him, including Warren, and a 21-year-old Mormon mother. So sort of an odd match, but apparently neither of their families, or at least his wife's family, didn't care for. So they have one child, it's Warren. And when Warren's nine, his dad won a Chickering brand piano in a poker game. The story is later immortalized in the song Piano Fighter off the Mutineer album. And so Warren loved the piano and was a prodigy. So when he was 13 and he was going to junior high school in San Pedro, California, which many of your listeners will know is the home of the Minutemen, Warren's band teacher thought he was a prodigy. So he took him into Hollywood to hang out with Stravinsky, who apparently was living in Hollywood at the time.
Igor.
Yeah. And what I love about that is, like, if you had told me that Stravinsky died in, like, 1836, I would have said, yeah, that sounds right to me. But no, apparently he was living in Hollywood in the 1950s or early 60s. So apparently it's kind of a weird scene. It's Stravinsky, it's Warren Zevon, and another guy who is, like Stravinsky's confidant. And they sip wine, even though Warren's 13, and have great conversation. Because in addition to being a piano prodigy, Warren Zevon is also apparently, you know, a genius, which is, I think, consistent with his lyrics and his between song banter. Yep. But so anyway, he goes and he hangs out at Stravinsky's house about 5 or 6 times. And they would analyze scores together, which is also amazing. So, Anyway, Zevon's parents had a tumultuous relationship, and Warren was frequently sort of bouncing back and forth between their houses. His mom lived in Fresno, and his dad sort of bounced around L.A. because, you know, he's a gambler. Sometimes he was flush. Other times he was busted. So Warren ends up going to Fairfax High School, which I believe is where the Red Hot Chili Peppers later went and met each other. But this is the early to mid 60s, and he meets a classmate named Violet Santangelo. And they, as I think all, you know, every other person in the 60s did, decided to form a folk duo, and they call it Lime, and it's either Cybele or Lime and Sybil. I'm not really sure how to pronounce the Cybele part of that. But so Warren called himself Stephen Lime. No capital letters in that. He did the E.E. Cummings thing. And apparently he lived in an all green apartment, wore nothing but green clothes, had green tinted glasses, and wore Lime cologne. That's Lime brand cologne. I'm not sure if it smelled like lime or was just spelled like lime, but you get the picture. So Lime and Cybele get signed to White Whale Records, and they put out a single in 1966. And the single, the A side is Follow Me, and the B side is Like the Seasons. And it was produced by Bones Howe, who would go on to produce records by the Association, and Tom Waits. And, you know, amazingly, as could happen in the 60s, it makes it to number 65 on the Billboard pop charts, despite the fact that I think they're still in high school or they're like fresh out of high school. So and then I think more importantly, Follow Me ends up finding its way onto the Nuggets box set that was compiled by Lenny Kaye. So it had real staying power. But now, if you guys happen to have it lying around, maybe we could listen to a little snippet of Follow Me. I love that. It sounds like, to me, it kind of reminds me of the Jefferson Airplane with like a flatter Grace Slick singing. And when Zevon comes in, like, you can totally tell it's him, but he's not sort of singing in his typical register. And, you know, the rap on Zevon, he was always like, great songwriter, can't sing. But I think he can really, I think he sounds great there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, you can hear hints of the sort of the folk rock Rolling Stones in there and the Birds and like all the stuff that was happening, but still very kind of a unique record. I can see where it's earned its place on Nuggets for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. What'd you think, Jim?
Yeah, it could not sound more like 60s to me.
Yeah.
It is like, I mean, I like that sound a lot, and I think you made a good comparison there, but it's just like, God, that is so dated today. You know what I mean? Like in a time capsule or something. But
yeah.
And I'll say, I know we'll talk probably more about this later, but I like Warren Zevon's singing, overall. And I think part of the reason why I like it so much is because he doesn't sound like a typical singer, right? He doesn't have that sort of like, you know, American Idol kind of voice, right? Mm-hmm. So to me, it always sounded much more personal that way. His music sounded much more personal and more emotional, because it just felt like, you know, this was just some guy just putting it out there, you know? So anyway, we'll get to that a little bit later.
Yeah. Yeah. And before I forget, because I might forget later, I mean, my feeling about guys where, you know, they're like, oh, he can't really sing, like Elvis Costello or Warren Zevon. Like I can't sing. When I go out and I sing, like, you never know what the hell note's going to come out. Like, you know, Zevon and Costello, they might not have the most pleasing voices in the world to some people's ears or be sort of technically perfect. But when they go out and sing, they sound like them. They can always hit the notes.
Yes.
And, you know, if you can do that, you can sing.
That's right. Better stated than I did. Okay.
All right. So Lyman Seibel did another single for White Whale. They did a cover of Bob Dylan's If You Gotta Go, Go Now, which promptly stiffed. And so Zevon leaves Lyman Seibel and gets replaced by another guy who becomes the new Lyme. And the new Lyme apparently was something of a megalomaniac, and he fired Seibel. But that's a different story that we can, you know, I can come back for another week and we can talk about that. But and at this point, Warren's not going by Warren. He calls himself Sandy Zevon because he's got kind of sandy hair. Anyway, you know, at some point, Bones Howe plays the song Outside Chance, the B-side to Follow Me for the rock band The Turtles. And The Turtles really like it, and they record it. It's they really like it, actually. They do not record Outside Chance. Sorry about that. I misread my notes. That's sort of the hazard of having bulky notes. So anyway, they start hanging out with Zevon. Zevon plays Like the Seasons, the B-side to the song we just listened to. And Howard Kalin, who later becomes Eddie when he and Mark Volman, I think, start calling themselves Flo and Eddie. Howard Kalin loves the song. So the Turtles record it and they release it as the B-side to Can I Get to Know You, or Can I Get to Know You Better? But apparently that single doesn't sell any copies. So, you know, it's not a hit for Warren. But Howard and Warren become great buddies. They're drug buddies, as Evan Dando would say. And they spend a lot of time sitting around and getting high, like really high. In fact, so high that Howard gets this crazy idea for the B-side to the Turtles' hit single, Happy Together, which I think I'm sure all of your listeners know. So I'm going to let Howard describe what happens next. And this quote comes from the Warren Zevon biography that was written by his ex-wife, Crystal, which we'll talk about at some length later in the week. So this is Howard Kalin explaining why they decided to record Like the Seasons as a B-side twice. He says, when we went into the studio at the beginning of 1967, we absolutely knew Happy Together was going to be a number one record. The owners of the record company said, this is going to be a number one record, so think very carefully about what you want to put on the B-side, because it's all gravy money. We were so naive and so decent that we said, let's put Warren's song on the B-side of this one, too. What? You've already used it as a B-side. I know, but that wasn't a hit. We want to give this guy every break that we can. I don't think I have higher praise for anybody that I've ever met or encountered in this field than to say, I realize this is money that could be going into my pocket. I would rather that it go into his. Believe me, we were not always this selfless. I don't remember doing that again, even with an ex-wife. But in Warren's case, he was a very, very special person. We wanted him to share our good fortune. So Happy Together wound up with Warren's song Like the Seasons as the B-side internationally. And of course, it sold millions and millions and millions of records.
I have learned that love can turn like the seasons. And I know you had to go, you've got your reasons. Still, I wish you'd stay. Tell me why you're going away. It hurts me not knowing, and I believe that love's like leaves in September that fall, and all I do is remember. Still, I wish you'd stay. Tell me why you're going away.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that amazingly sounds even more dated.
It does.
I mean, like, than the last one. It reminds, my mom loves, like, Peter, Paul, and Mary and, like, all sorts of, like, really kind of maudlin folk. And that's, I spent a lot of my childhood listening to that on 8-track as we were rolling in the car. And that, I mean, that would have fit right in there.
Totally.
You know, it also, for Warren Zevon, sounds, you know, surprisingly sappy, right?
Yeah.
Does not have the kind of lyrical, you know, the sort of lyrical sting that he would grow into later, right?
But at the same time, I mean, I haven't listened to this since I started working on the show notes, like, you know, months ago. I liked it way better than I remember liking it when I was listening to it on my phone. I mean, it's like he really, as I kind of like the expression that people use a lot this day, like these days, leaned into it. I mean, like he really leaned into the maudlin sort of aspects of that. Yeah, I mean, that was a platinum record for Warren Zevon.
There you go.
It was not it was a two-sided single. And
that's right.
He wrote the far lesser side.
But so, how many people got tired of Happy Together and actually turned it over and played it? It'd be interesting to know, right?
Yeah. I mean, God, Happy Together is like the greatest song in the world. I remember they used to do public ice skating at this rink in my town, and Friday nights they would play rock and roll. And I remember first time I heard Happy Together, I was like, what? I mean, I was nine. I was like, what is this song?
Right.
And I kept going back. I was a terrible skater and I didn't even really like it, but I just kept going back because they would always play the song. And I was like, this is amazing.
It really is. When you think about it, it really is a great pop song, isn't it? Got that huge chorus, but anyway, that's another show. All right.
It's another week.
So around the same time, Zevon meets Kim Fowley, the Lord of Garbage. That's the title of his autobiography.
Right.
So Kim Fowley's a gross hipster guy in his late 20s who likes to spend a lot of time with teenage girls. And he allegedly raped Jackie Fox of the Runaways, who he later managed. I think Danny Ingram, the drummer in Dot Dash, may even have talked about this when we came to your house and
did
that show. But there was a time in the 80s when Kim Fowley was trying to sign Strange Boutique. And again, you know, Kim Fowley, you know, there's the Jackie Fox thing, and there also, I mean, Danny did not like him at all, and it sort of ended with Kim Fowley threatening to shoot Danny, which oddly, in spite of the fact that Danny is one of the nicest people I know, that was not the first time that someone threatened to shoot Danny. But I digress. So anyway, Warren gets a deal with Imperial Records. And Kim Fowley says that he got him the deal. But the former Beach Boy, David Marks, says that his mom got Warren the deal because, David Marks's mom apparently worked at Imperial. But, anyway, Warren goes into the studio with Kim Fowley producing. But, you know, Kim Fowley is sort of a notoriously mercurial character, and I think Warren is as well. And so about halfway through the recording, something goes wrong, and all of a sudden Fowley's out. So Warren finishes the record anyway. It comes out. It's called Wanted Dead or Alive, and once again, nobody buys it. So let's listen to a song off this called She Quit Me.
It wasn't the Queen of Diamonds that I drew first. Instead, I got the Ace of Spades reversed. She quit me. She quit me. She quit me. I
it wasn't because I didn't treat her right. No.
Okay.
God. So that's like a total death march. It's like dirgy folk blues with lousy singing. although maybe I'm
Other
wrong.
Than that,
what did you
yeah.
guys think?
No, you're right.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. And it doesn't get any better from there.
Yeah. So anyway, in the meantime, Warren has moved in with a woman named Marilyn Livingston who calls herself Tuli. And Zevon actually had a song called Tuli's Blues, which from time to time would show up as like an outtake. I don't think it ever made it onto a proper album, but it was about her. And so Warren and Tuli have a son named, Jordan. And Zevon's broke. He's got a family. He's got a support. So Bones Howe, the guy that produced the Lyman Cybele single, decides he's going to help him out by getting the song She Quit Me, which we just heard on the Midnight Cowboy soundtrack. But, wisely and not surprisingly, they don't use Warren's version. They had Leslie Miller sing it and they changed the title and the words to He Quit Me and gave it a whole different vibe.
It wasn't the Queen of Diamonds I'd refer to. Instead I found the Ace of Spades. The Ace of Spades reversed.
I mean, talk about turning crap into something right. amazing.
Yeah, right?
That's, I mean, I love that. It's like this kind of like sub Dusty Springfield thing with it.
Yeah.
I mean, just an yes. awesome bass line.
Yes.
And what I kind of love about that is like, again, Bones Howe totally hooked them up. Like that, that Warren Zevon song, they didn't need to use that song to make something that awesome. He just like turned it into something really, really great. It reminds me of like, you know, I could see Quentin Tarantino like excavating that for a movie of his
totally.
At some point in the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
Totally. And it really, I've never heard this soundtrack, but that's one of my favorite movies, Midnight Cowboy. And so it totally fits the vibe of that movie. So the musical supervision of John Barry, I think, really helped.
Yeah. So anyway, the Midnight Cowboy soundtrack goes gold largely on the strength of Everybody's Talking by Harry Nilsson. Mm-hmm. And so Zevon's got a second hit record when he's still in his early 20s. So obviously he is on the cusp of stardom and it's going to be all, you know, gold records and millions of dollars from here.
All right. Well, this is a great setup to the Warren Zevon story the part of his career that people will start to become familiar with him. So this is good. There's all this great background. And I think you're right, Patrick. It was a revelation for me to learn the same thing about Lou Reed when you learn that like he was like a songwriter first and like writing for other people or doing this stuff. And I think it has to do also with their environments. So, you know, in Lou Reed's case, New York, but in, you know, Zevon, you know, growing up in L.A. and being somebody who is obviously, you know, smart and creative, that's just what you would do, right? And you're sort of like automatically, though, like in the industry. It's not a DIY approach. It's like it's like meeting people and networking and getting gigs, you know what I mean? And becoming and sort of ingraining yourself in that business.
playing the game, and if you have to wear lime glasses and change your name, you do that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, but that's a great point, Jim. I mean, Arthur Lee did the same thing. You know, just these guys were in high school and they were hustling. They were playing gigs. They were selling songs to, like, you know, it seemed like there was a small record label on every block, and these guys would go and they'd work them. And it's, you know, now high school bands that actually do anything are such a novelty. People are like, oh, like, isn't that amazing? But like you said, that's what it was in the 60s. So that was the industry.
That's right. That's right. And it's so different. You know, you started this off by talking about how you only listened to hardcore for a good period of your life. What the hardcore bands did was such a different approach to this, right? It was all about DIY, do it yourself, just play, make your own music. You don't care. And I think it's when you are the type of music fan who really gravitates to that kind of music, it's almost kind of, I found this to be the case for myself too. It's almost kind of harder to even understand the professional side of the music business. Like, how does that work? Yeah. That seems so crazy to me. It just, you know, it seems so complicated and difficult. But I think to people like Warren who just kind of grew up in it, that's the way you built a career, right? So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you raise a fascinating point also, is it's like, yeah, hardcore was like totally outside the industry, but that's maybe because the industry was so different by like the late 70s, early 80s.
I mean, totally.
You couldn't, if you were just some high school kid that, you know, was not a virtuoso, you couldn't even walk in the door because, again, they were interested in like player and really like stuff that was impeccably played. And so maybe, you know, maybe had they been there in the 60s, maybe the hardcore kids would have been doing the same thing. And it's just, that's what they were forced to do in the 70s and 80s.
Well said.
Let's move on. We're going to go deeper into the Warren Zevon story the rest of the week.
Mm-hmm.
Hunter's going to stick with us all week. We've got him on speed dial so we can get him back tomorrow.
That's right. Right? Yeah.
Hotline. He's not going anywhere. None of us are going anywhere, right? So we'll get him. All right. So let's just move on to that. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us is
Hunter Bennett.
And we'll talk to you guys tomorrow.
I don't think I have higher praise for anybody that I've ever met or encountered in this field than to say, I realize this is money that could be going into my pocket. I would rather that it go into his.